So, thank you. So just to give something like this, so related to some of the issues that has also been discussed in the workshop, of course the most dramatic one is the idea that the stability constant problem. Then there is the issues on of the IR issues, whether they have an effect on kernel inflation and possible effects on observables. And then there is the thing that Steve discussed in his blog the other day, that there could be a relation to black hole physics. And then finally, there is the possibility that if we have a systematic understanding of the IR effects, it could lead to new insights or techniques that we are not aware of. So, just to elaborate a little bit on the demonstrations, it is well known that the variance of a massive scalar field in the sitter has some kind of this has prompted some people to believe that the sitter space could be unstable. For instance, that this feature of the sitter could lead to an amplification of metric perturbations and other field perturbations over time, and that could lead to some kind of instability. So here are some people who are on the top here at the conference who have been proponents of the instabilities. So then, in internal inflation, internal periodic inflation in our batches, starting in, after the self-reproduction regime, very close to the time scale. And then it goes on when the effect of field theory approach becomes viable. And then it goes on for a long time, down to the dot scale. And that means that the total inflated volume is exponentially larger than the volume needed to explain our observed real works. So this huge volume means that there is going to be large IR corrections to correlators, group corrections. And of course, we need to know how to deal with that. And then finally, the possible new insights. So, that a proper or systematic understanding of the IR issues for people. So, here I just mentioned some two examples. Of course, there are many more examples, but the first one is again the one that has people in relation to the dipole information pattern, which I will come back to briefly at the end of the talk. And then something that I won't talk about in this talk, but if you impose, if you require a major stability of the sitter space as a physical condition, you can use that to derive an upper bound and the endpoint correlation of non-Gaussianity as observed in the CMB to all orders in N. So, some things that can be inferred from understanding IR issues. So here is an outline of my talk. So first I will discuss, it consists of three parts, and first I will discuss the sitter space. Then I will go on and discuss the slow unification. And then I will discuss some interpretations of the results.
Pardon?
What?
You said you're going to get non-Gaussianity tall orders, and I just wondered what n was.
So n is just like the 3-point function, the 4-point function, the 5-point function, whatever. So n is the, the high spectrum, the high spectrum, and so on.
What does that photograph mean?
What?
What does that photograph mean?
That photograph is a test probe.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so so let's start with considering tensor fluctuations in the sitter, and let's try to understand their effect on the 2-point function of a massless set scalar field. So we can write the metric in this form, where we put the metric perturbation in the exponent here, so gamma is transverse and phaseless, and then its effect obviously would be to shift the momentum in this way, right? So I can expand the shifted momentum in the in the Bessel fields. So then, of course, I could take my 2-point correlation function on the background of some soft gravitar mode that has the shifting the momentum, like we saw.
Excuse me, just a minute. This is an assumption, right?
No. Okay. So.
This is your fundamental assumption that that's the way that the 2-point correlator depends on the metric function.
So if it comes from here, it comes from the metric answers.
K squared depends on the metric the way it depends on the metric always.
So dx is a so k is the Fourier transform of x. So it depends on.
But if I looked at corrections to the propagator, right? I mean, there'd be all sorts of weird corrections, non-local corrections, integrals over time, and stuff.
So the underlying assumption here is that I can that a long wavelength graviton mode, I can consider it as a classical mode, right? So it's a classical perturbation of the matrix. So I can expand my 2-point function to a classical perturbation of the matrix. So I have my long wavelength. Semi-classical mode here, which I'm preferring my my 2-point correlation function. So expanding my 2-point function on that background, I get a Taylor series.
I'm sorry for being tricky. I just want to understand. I'm not questioning but, or not objecting, but so the sigmas are at the same time, right?
Yes.
So it's sigma at time and sigma at time, and the assertion is that it depends functionally on the instantaneous gamma ij at that time, and that there's no stuff in the past.
There's no time in the past. Okay, that's true. So then I can, of course, average this expansion over all the soft Fredesmann modes so I can put an infrared cutoff in this averaging procedure, which is some box, some size. So if the box is large compared to this, to the wavelength of the soft gravitar modes, I call it a large box. So taking this average over soft gravitar modes, I basically just take the averages here, right? So I write like this. So in order to evaluate these terms, I do a mode expansion of the graviton, and the mode solution for the graviton is like that for a free master scale of human decision. So the variance, if you want to compute the variance of the graviton, is very much like the variance of a master street skeleton. So it's higher at the gradient like the one I showed in the introduction. So now we can use this to evaluate those two terms here, right? By doing the polarization sums, and we can write the average two terms of this variance. So if you're looking at this expression, you see that there is always something, there is already something that looks to become large in the IR because this was IR diverging. But interestingly, in the CIDR, the three-level two-point function, one-dimensional two-point function, is the scale invariant. So those two terms, by taking the derivatives, actually cancels out, and you get zero for the correction in the zero space. So, what seems to be the case is that whenever you have a scale invariant correlation function, there are no IR effects. So the symmetries of the CIDR protecting those correlators from achieving acquiring large IRFs. So of course we could look at an example which is not scale invariant to see that This is the counter thing.
So this was just to dwell loop order, right?
Yeah, so you can in principle
classical. Only classical loops.
Mm-hmm. So this is effectively
this is one loop.
Yeah, so this is a one loop essay?
But classical loop. I mean, there's a
So this is what corresponds for one loop essay?
That was what Richard and collaborators are claiming as two loop, not one loop.
On this correlate, I would be surprised.
Yes.
So but of course you can compute it by continuing this Taylor
chain. Uh-huh. But you don't know whether that's gonna the cancellation is gonna persist, or do you know that?
I would expect it to persist.
The symmetry issue.
Because of the symmetry issue. So I could take a non-scaling variant correlator, which is just I could take the two-point function of sigma dot, which is not scaling variant, and then the IR iterating part will not cancel out. So
I have a question. I read your paper and I have a question about this. So it's a really strong assertion to say that the exact two-point correlator for the scalar at the same time depends functionally the way that you have it on gamma ij of t. I think that could only be true in some approximate sense. And my question is, how do you know that the approximate sense in which that's true doesn't give rise to corrections which would become important for being off the center that might cancel this effect? So you're sort of taking account of only one going off the center type correction. How do you know that there might not be corrections for going off the center coming in that expansion itself?
Going off the center.
So you're taking account of the scalar spectral index not being exactly
no, not yet. This is still just the center. It's just that I'm looping at a correlator that contains derivatives in it, and then it's not scaling.
Okay, so then my question is, how do you know that subdominant effects in so you're looking at a subdominant effect coming from derivatives? How do you know that? I disbelieve that scalar propagator can really depend so simply as you have it. That could only be true at some level of approximation. How do you know that corrections to that approximation can't come in and hit the de Sitter term and cancel?
Because it's the semi-classical limit of the full computation. So let me show you in a minute. So as a check, if you have doubts, you can of course check this result by doing a full quantum computation using the string and Djokovic formula. And if you do so, you find that the contributing diagrams and the IR to this correlator is given by these two diagrams, where you have a graviton running here. So you can evaluate those two diagrams. Of course, turns out that
and you did those exactly in De Sitter with full renormalization, full BPHD renormalization, right?
Yeah. So we evaluated the this using the full inner formalism and the infrared linker. So you can do it the way you want, but I mean, I just want to stress that there is an efficient way of evaluating this type of diagrams in the inner formalism, which is fleshed out in this paper, which uses the symmetries of the diagram. So if you follow this diagrammatic set of rules, then there are fewer diagrams to evaluate. But anyway, if you do so, you find that the full inner calculation exactly reproduces the result of the semi-classical relation. And not only it reproduces the result of the semi-classical relation, but in fact, the inner calculation of each of those two diagrams reproduces exactly each of the two terms from the semi-classical relation. So those two times here actually corresponds exactly to those two diagrams. And there is an exact match.
I think there's another Feynman diagram, same order, but it's have four, have a scalar inside the loop.
Yeah, so those should be the red one.
Not for a test scalar.
What?
We just look, if you just look at, say, that's with a scalar self-interaction.
Yeah, okay. So this is a free test scalar. Sorry?
This is a spectator scalar.
You
didn't, so Emery Kepka and I have an exact result for the scalar self-mass squared in exact de Sitter. Mm. Did you, I haven't done it, but did you check against that exact result to see whether you agree with that? So we have an exact, fully dimensionally regulated, fully linearly renormalized exact result with the full thing, no approximation, both of those diagrams. Did you check to see whether your simplified rules agree with that at the leading?
Is that in momentum space?
No, it's in position space, but it's of course trivial to sure. Fourier transform.
No, so we checked against our own calculation. So we didn't check this.
Okay, so that'd be interesting.
But in your own calculation, you what you call quantum calculation, you put the alpha at cut of H, right?
I put what?
Alpha at cut of H.
Sorry.
Alpha at cut of H. That's what you do.
Ultraviolet.
So I don't need to bother about the ultraviolet. I mean, but in principle, I mean, you just have to regularize the ultraviolet and renormalize it in the.
The point is, we're extracting the leading IR contribution, and that doesn't depend on the ultraviolet.
But, I mean, you're trying to check a calculation that is a classical infrared calculation by another infrared calculation. So
so you can write down the loop diagrams and extract the leading infrared contribution to the actual calculated loops.
Can we let the speaker continue?
So let me continue to the second part, which is the plural part. So then, of course, there is another way to achieve non-scale invariant correlators, which would be affected by a large inverse effect, and that is by basically breaking one of the de Sitter symmetries, in this case time translation invariant, and it's broken by the slow roll of the scalar field, and it's almost flat potential, and it's approximate or a small breaking of time translation invariant is parametrized in terms of the slow roll of parameters. So of course the spectrum of some 2-point correlation function in a slow roll background is not exactly scale invariant, and the breaking of scale invariance is parameterized by the spectral index, which is given by the slow roll parameter. So the limit of the slow roll parameter is going to 0. This the same equals 0. So you would then expect that there could be large infrared effects in that case. So just to clarify a little bit what we calculate, it's just compare the usual gauges. So in cosmology, we often want to work in the full moment gauge, where there are no fluctuations in the scalar field, and the physical scalar fluctuations, which comes from the breaking of the time translation invariance, is put in the curvature equation in metric. Another gauge is that you can put the physical scalar perturbation in the fluctuations of the amplitude field, and you have a homogeneous metric. Then the benefit for a cosmologist of thinking this way is that the theta is conserved in large scales. So when making observational predictions, it's very nice to phrase them in terms of theta, because theta is conserved on delay times, and so like in any physical problem, it's nice to frame observables in terms of a conserved quantity. And it can be shown that this is in fact a non-perturbative conserved, so it's conserved all over on large scales. And there is, of course, a linear gauge transformation. I mean, to linear, there is a gauge transformation between the two variables, and for linear order, it's a very simple one. It's a very simple relation between these two guys.
Sorry, what is your gauge fixing condition in the second gauge? So,
I think it must be that the metric is in the modular, right?
But that fixes e to the gamma. You're saying it's flat, or is that?
So there's one physical scalar coming to the region. And I mean, so okay. So if you want to do all the gauge fixing, so you put this answer into something like the ADM formulas and stuff like this. But of course, I'm allowed to choose. I mean, a gauge where the physical scalar degree of freedom is what I want.
I understand. I'm just going to see what is the gauge condition in the second case.
Gamma is traced.
Gamma is traced.
You were wondering about that. Okay, it's the same. For the gamma, it's the same. So gamma, if you want, is the gauge invariant undergoing from this case to this case.
Yeah, but the question is because there was a typo, right?
What?
I mean, what you mean is that dt square, you're not fixing dt square to be 1. And the 0R component. These are N, N, and R. They're keeping them fixed in this gauge, right?
Sorry, I didn't
say that. That's missing.
What?
That's missing.
Yeah, no, I didn't write the last
one. That was my last one.
You have to put this into the Delta formulation to fix the constraints. Sure, yeah, absolutely. I only put the physical degree of the freedom. Okay, so then you can calculate say the 2-point function of theta, the scalar degree of freedom, in the background of self gravitons.
Okay, just one so that's zeta of t, right? And you're making that same assumption that the dependence on the gamma ij variable is just what you would get in the homogeneous background if you just replaced all k squares by e to the gamma ij ki kj, right? That's the assumption?
Yeah.
Okay.
So so you can expand, again, your correlator on the background, on the shifted background, which is shifted by these long-wavelength gravitons. And the effect is the same as before for the shift of momentum. You can tailor expand. And then you can take the average again in a large box, and you get of course the same results as before, but now this derivative doesn't vanish because this is no longer scale invariant, and instead you get a result which is suppressed by some slow road parameter. So this vanishes in the limit of the slow road parameter going to zero. So. And I just repeated here is, I mean, of course, the large quantities in there.
So in the slow road background, how did you choose this mode function or this theta?
In the slow road case, the mode function is given by
the
theoretical one? What? No. So the mode equation is the one on the slow road background. I mean, it's so you have, if it was the decider one, it would not give a slow operation.
You had a special symmetry, such as the power spectrum still was that scalar invariant. So yeah, cancellation, then you would be okay.
If you had an exact scalar invariant spectrum, you would have a cancellation.
So there could be a separate thing that's still slow. Yes,
yeah, if there were an other symmetry predicting this spectrum to the scalar invariant, you would still have a cancellation. And of course, you could do the same with tensor to look at the effect of tensor loops on the tensor spectrum. So you could of course also look at scalar loops. So you could look at how a long wavelength scalar mode shifts affects the momentum in these cases. And then you can again expand your correlator on a long wavelength scalar mode. So now here you just have to take into account that the Jacobian of this transformation is not 1, so there is an additional modulo factor there. But otherwise, it's the same. And by averaging again in the last part, you get something like this. So you get again the one loop corrected scalar spectrum rated on under scalar loops in the last box, which is IATA version. And you can do the same looking at scalar loops on tensor correlation functions. Okay, so when did I start?
You have about 13 minutes.
13 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, so in fact, maybe I won't talk too much about this because actually Arthur already discussed very nicely in his talk some of these issues. So let me, since time is not so long, let me jump a little bit. Let me just say that you can of course look at now at the effect of other observables in the large box, which would, for instance, I mean, just to mention something, you could think of the tensor to scalar ratio, which is a relation that cosmologists like to think about. Because it has a, there is a consistency relation, single field relation that tells you that this relation should be given by the spherical parameter. And then using the symmetrical relations, you can of course see how one loop effect shifts this relation around in the large box. And if you have the large loop rate fixtures. And you can do the same with non-Gaussian energy, of course. I mean, it's another. So you know that the tri-spectrum, the bi-spectrum of non-Gaussian energy is defined in terms of the three-point function, and we typically parameterize that in terms of the non-linearity parameter F and L, which in single field inflation, in the squeeze limit where one of the momentum is much smaller than the other two, is given by this consistency relation, Mandelsina, which is F and L is equal to the spectral so basically.
So what is your alpha?
What alpha?
The running.
This one? Yes. This is basically the running of the spectral index.
Okay.
So it comes when you take the derivatives in these relations. You also hit with the derivatives on the spectral index, of course. So you get some running. And so, okay, so you get a correction. So those infrared corrections turns up basically in all your observables and in the last box. So then there is then we could of course try to estimate in some model at least whether how large they will be between, as I mentioned in the beginning, say the chaotic inflation between the end of the self-reproduction regime and the time of reheating in the large box. Not in our local patch, but in the full large, full inflated box. And so, so basically, okay. So the main point is just that the size of the infrared effect can be parameterized by this quantity, which is the one that appears for the scalar loops everywhere, like here. This is what is called. GIR here, right? So, and then for the tensor loops, the fractional sizes can be parameterized by this, right? So, if these becomes of order 1, it means that the loop effects are order 1. So, if one considers just some standard monomial chaotic inflation, starting in the separate production machine, then when there is 60 EFOs left on inflation in the full box, these quantities do become order 1. So it does mean that you have entered a non-Hodge regime in the large box. So what does it mean? So first of all, there is this connection with the lateral information patterns that Steve has been stating. So basically, as you know, I mean, if you drop something into a black hole, it appears to be lost. And if you want to avoid problems with unitarity, it has the information of it has to be entangled in that way, open radiation. So then of course nothing special happens to the things going through the horizon, and you have basically a problem with comparison in that case of information being reproduced inside and outside the spectrum. And this is a nice slice of having this leads to a paradox. So so this paradox could be an indication that the superlative approach in which the calculation has been made basically fails at some time scale, which is given by of order the black hole evaporation time, which is the time which is only the time which information has to get out of the black hole, right? So indeed, one could can identify a source of a perturbative breakdown. It would indicate that, in fact, there is not really a paradox, but only a problem has been set of understanding this non-perturbative machine. So then it has been proposed that since the sitter and black hole spacetimes have some similarities, that there should be a parallel in the sitter space, and there should be a breakdown in the sitter space on a time scale, which is similar, except that the time scale is set by the Hubble wave. So if we measure the variance, we remember it grows like this. So here it grows like the Hubble wave to the power 3 times t. So it becomes of order 1 on a time scale, which is given exactly by the time scale which you would have expected by this parallel to the black hole information paradox. Let me also discuss. Okay, so now I basically only talked about this breakdown of this of the perturbative regime in the large box, but of course we are not able to observe the full inflated volume of the sitter. So you may of course ask yourself about the local interpretation for an observer. So just forget about the tensor modes for a second. But if you split the scalar modes into a short wavelength, the fluctuating scalar mode, and a long wavelength, homogeneous mode, which is constant on the scales accessible to some observer, then as shown by, or first discussed by Unruh and since by many, many others, you can of course take this constant piece and make it into a constant shift of your local scale factor. And since the overall normalization of the scale factor is not something physical, it should not have some physical effect locally. So in fact,
rather than this, if you have an entropy field around, then I would disagree with that.
Yeah. So this. So this is for a single.
Only adiabatic.
Yeah, I agree. But anyway, so just to see how it goes. Okay, you can of course also neglecting for a moment the running of the spectrum. You can just make the shift in the spectrum, and you recover, of course. So then this, by making the shift of the scale factor in the spectrum, you can expand this exponential and you get the same series as before locally. So this shows that locally, where you can treat this effect to be constant homogeneous and absorbed in a local renormalization of the scale factor, this effect can mimic the effect of the shift in the momentum from the long wavelength modes. So this series is the same as you would get from the same classical relation locally. So so a possible conclusion on this is that the caveat of isocurvature mode and all this is that that for local observers these effects may be resumed or absorbed into the background and eliminated from the viewpoint of a local observer, but globally they can have an important effect for our understanding of the various issues, such as global properties of the Sitter space, quasi Sitter space. So now I jumped a bit, so now I'm maybe finished before time. I don't know. So, okay, not really.
We're running so late. I'm glad.
Okay, so, but anyway, so so let me just show some summary of conclusions here. So, so basically, we found simple semi-classical relations for deriving the IR loop effects during inflation, right? Those semi-classical relations basically provide you a Taylor expansion which captures the leading losses. We check those semi-classical relations with exact NN populations, and we could show that the exact NN population match the result of the semi-classical relations on a diagram-to-diagram basis, basically. And then, of course, we, in order to make these checks with the NN population, we found the more efficient approach for writing down the diagrams, a more efficient diagrammatic approach to the NN solution, which is useful if one wants to go and check some of these things with full NN populations. This makes it more efficient. And then we showed that the IR effects can become large in the total inflated volume in some realistic, or maybe I should not say realistic, but it's popular models of inflation. This indicates that that there is a perturbative breakdown on a time scale in the Sitter, which coincides with the time scale at which you would expect a perturbative breakdown in the black hole case. So that's it.
Questions?
May I come back to the issue of example, close conflation? Again, you said that field observations become large or can become very large in big numbers, right?
Yeah.
And in particular, you link parametrically the tensor perturbations to the statement of Arkady Ahmed and company when inflation breaks down to the time scale T equals R times S. So is it true that the parametrically is the same? I'm confused about what is the equivalence to Arkady Ahmed's breakdown. Is it that the scalars become large or that the tensors become large?
So
the function GIR, you had some different slides with the function GIR, these numbers. Here, yeah. Is it the same for your function HIR?
So I think for HIR, the numbers are slightly smaller, but I think the time scale is roughly the same.
But they are still much larger than one.
I think actually for HIR, they are slightly less than one.
Less than one?
Yes, slightly less.
Okay, I see. Okay, great. Thank you.
I think you were next.
Thank you. So for the black hole information paradox, you have the it is like half of the black hole have been evaporated, so that we can extract the information from that. From this Sitter, we have the same intuition like Don Hayes' argument.
There's no precise analog of the
the quote paradox unquote in the total reasoning. But it is this statement that if you're trying to capture the state on this entire slice, you can have similar problems in the center space and potentially in the black hole.
So is it possible to formulate like this then? Because the scalar field perturbation and the vacuum energy has energy exchange from the, because particle creation is like create energy from the vacuum, and in the IR mode it like scale energy back to the vacuum, and can we try to calculate the exchange of energy and see that the exchange of energy is of order the vacuum energy itself, and that time might be the analog of black hole case.
I'm not sure. It's probably something to discuss after.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I agree. Questions for the speaker?
So, you understand the contribution from the long wave length model, the adiabatic contribution. And as a quantization, there is a quantization, you are including the influence from the
so you need to
select
the
initial state, so that's
such
gauge mode
you know. So how do you think about it? So here the initial state is the point state state, and this is just a straightforward calculation of the usual parameters that you have in the
So, are you saying that there's no observable effect? Because what's going on in the large box is purely of academic interest, right?
Or it has to become observable when you start to count the entropy of the center space of our calculation.
Did you say that, or did you say that it could be subsumed into a...
I think, okay, so what I said, I mean, is that certainly in the, okay, so that comes also a little bit back to Robert's point, but certainly in the case of single field slow roll inflation, there is no observable effect of the scalar modes. That's the exact statement.
I wanted to ask about that. I was a little bit confused by your statement there. So I interpreted what you were saying as that the effect of the vastly super horizon modes could be, it wasn't that it wasn't there, it's just that it could be subsumed into a redefinition of constant parameters, like, for example, maybe the scalar is a little bit further
but
down
the
its potential.
The problem with the, if it ends, okay, so what I show there is that you can absorb it in a constant shift of the scale factor,
right?
But the overall normalization of the scale factor is not something physical.
But suppose somebody wanted to take a real hard-ass point of view. Look, I have an exact model of inflation. I know exactly what the scalar potential is. And you're getting a shift with that scalar potential.
No, because, I can always normalize my scale factor to be 1 today.
Let's see. Suppose somebody wants to take a really hard-ass point of view. I know exactly what the scale factor
is. If you want to take a really hard-ass point of view, you'd better ask what the gauge invariant observables are.
Okay, fair enough, but suppose I take the point of view that I know exactly what the scale of potential is and I know exactly when I start inflation, right? And you're getting that those things change. You're just getting that things change in such a way that
I think, to be honest, I think that there are interesting questions to be asked, but I really don't think that the effect of of scalar modes in single field slow roll inflation is the right way to look at it.
Fair enough. I think I agree with you completely, but let me just be clear about something. I think you are getting that there's a shift in those things. You're just getting that the effect on density perturbations could be subsumed into some change of maybe what one calls V or what one calls the start of inflation. But there is a change.
I don't think there's even a
that I don't understand at all. No, can you go back to the statement where you subsume that?
in observation, you have to specify a pivot point anyway.
Okay.
We did not mean a pivot point, right?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was clear. Maybe I wasn't. So you take a hard-ass point of view. You've got exactly what V is, and you know exactly when you started inflation.
Aha, right? Okay, so. If
you're getting that those things can be subsumed into redefinitions of what you call those things, and I agree, and maybe that's not observable, but you are getting that something changed.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. So okay, so I think his answer is the right one, right? I mean, you normal. I mean, okay, so yeah, you have to normalize the spectrum to the observed one.
So
basically, the monopole of your spectrum, you have to normalize the observation.
Thomas, I'm going to take what Richard calls a hard ass point of view. Thanks, Thomas.
It's crucial for the reply to Richard. Normalize from the end of iteration. If you normalize from the reheating point, then the effects can really be completely subsumed, and there's nothing left. And you will agree with that if you think of normalizing from the end, not from the beginning of the
situation. Don't you get that the quantum corrections alter the qualitative shape of the amplitude potential?
That you don't allow for the rest of
my comment. Sorry, that's precisely what was my comment, exactly. I mean,
oh, sorry, okay. So, I'll show you tomorrow. Okay, so we agree.
Okay. I'll show you physical attack that can change qualitative nature of potential. And then, well. But anyway, let me pause my question.
Okay.
Quickly. Yeah, so let me say that I understand. Well, let me ask my question in such a way to see what I understood what you're trying to say. Let's assume I'm a super observer, that means that I'm an observer that can see things locally.
Mm.
But I'm connected with, let's say, wormholes to all the other observers in the universe. And I can communicate, therefore, with them. My other things are. So what I'm going to see, am I going to see smaller or larger quantum effects?
My impression is that what you will see is that you will see that there will be a variance in what the you different guys has observed.
So the
which will be described by this, yeah.
So the effect will be, how could the effect is actually bigger than I see locally?
There will be a big difference in what you different guys observe. And on average, you will observe something like this.
Any really pressing questions? Yes.
It's a little bit going back to the point that I've made. This moment observing a long wavelength zeta into the scale factor relies really on the fact that you can separate them at one point and it's not going to come back and come to that. But if you're looking at something that's being produced during inflation, at every point there are more crossing the horizon, and then you have to
define.
So that's why the stochastic effect that Richard was talking might really not allow you to do reabsorb the long wavelength.
So you have to do this at some point, yeah. I mean, so you say 60 EFOs before the end of inflation, you do this.
Yeah,
but afterwards, then the effect will be small, because now you have gotten rid of all the large effects, and then there will only be small loop effects left.
Okay, so I agree, but...
So this is basically saying that I can take, an effective approach, where I take my large logs to be the size of this observed universe, and then... Of course, all those logs will be very small, but...
In principle, for example, one thing that Mirash and I looked a long time ago was that even for this Leighton EFO, if I have a special feature in the potential, even though this effect is still IR, it might give you some observable.
In the single field?
Because if I assume I have a very smooth potential, I agree with you. This is an IR effect, but it's only for the last 60 folding, so it should be small. But if, for example, I have a kink in my potential at some point during the last folding, it might change the spectrum.
Okay, I think we should stop for lunch, or we won't have lunch. So, thank this video.